Nurses and Hypochondriacs, the podcast that brings nurse experts, patients, and hypochondriacs together to discuss hot topics in healthcare. And here is your host, Ercilia Pompilio.
Former First Lady Barbara Bush recently made headlines with her death. Not because it was one of those typical celebrity deaths, you know, like suicide, drug overdose, or taxes, but because in the days leading up to her death, she chose comfort care, also known as palliative care, and the right to die at home instead of continuing on with her medical treatment to prolong her life. She's being applauded with starting that difficult discussion that many of us, including myself, don't want to talk about. Well, you know who wants to talk about it, though? For some reason, my dates. One date in particular, a couple weeks ago, on the first date, started the conversation as he told me that he figured out he had about 35 summers left to live. And on date number two, he said he had recalculated and figured out that he had about 40 summers left to live. And there was no date number three, so at this point, I don't even know if he's still alive. But of course, he could be stuck in Los Angeles traffic, or he could have fallen off a cliff, or he's probably eating a Subway sandwich. Who knows? But our podcast today, we're going to be talking about that difficult conversation called death, hospice and palliative care. And we open our podcast with a story told by Lisa Medway. She's a TV writer for the last 38 years, a WGA member since 1980. She's also an instructor in the writers program at UCLA Extension since 1995, a member of SAG-AFTRA since 1975, and she's also does storytelling and stand-up comedy among town, and she's a mom to three sons. Our nurse expert joining us is Michelle Lasota. Michelle is a 15-year veteran of the nursing profession, having begun her career practicing neural trauma ICU in Los Angeles at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. She currently resides back home in Philadelphia, where she actively practices as a board-certified hospice and palliative care nurse of the past 13 years. More recently, Michelle was selected as a titular subject of a documentary honoring hospice care workers entitled The Nurse with the Purple Hair, as directed by Sean S. Cunningham, who is more famously known as the creator of the Friday the 13th franchise. Please join us for part one of that difficult conversation.
My mother was very stubborn. My mother was very vain, and my mother was bedridden for 7.5+ years before she died, 6 weeks shy of her 97th birthday. She was in hospice for almost 2 years. When she took to her bed, it was out of vanity. It was out of not wanting to be seen, not wanting to fall. Her bed became a life raft, and her bed soon was replaced by a hospital bed, and she had round-the-clock caregivers. And then the doctor prescribed nurses for her twice a week, probably 4 years before she died. And it was one of her fabulous nurses who would come to her home. Everything was in her room, in this bed. She wouldn't go downstairs. Eventually, she wouldn't even go down the hall to the bathroom. And it was one of her home care nurses who suggested that she was now a candidate for hospice care. And everything was a huge relief. It was just years of stress because we were dealing with someone who had no other symptoms except she was old. And my mother was very stubborn. She was not expressive. She was a taciturn, bitter youngish lady, middle-aged woman, and let's say the last time that I know the last time she came to my house was when she was 89 for her birthday. That was the last time I could move to Nome, Alaska. She wouldn't have known. So when she was having one of her Grey Gardens, My Life in the Key of Me, narcissistic tirades, she said, I'm alone, I'm all alone. I said, Mom, you're not alone. What am I, a mirage? I'm standing right here. You're not alone. So then she needed a rewrite and said, I'm going to die alone. I said, Mom, you're not going to die alone. This was 5.5 years before she died. She said, how do you know? You're not a doctor. And I said, Mom, you're not going to be alone because someone's going to be holding the pillow over your face. And that means somebody's going to be there with you. So, of course, I tried to mitigate all of her drama and negativity and gloom with just being the sarcastic, nasty bitch daughter. But I am writing a book called The Designated Daughter, and it tracks my relationship with my mother, particularly in these very stressful, agonizing last years of her life, where she chose to be housebound and bedridden. So not to hog the podcast, be a podcast hog, but the point is that when Giti, her lovely, patient, compassionate home nurse, recommended hospice care, her doctor referred us to a hospice company. I cannot speak more highly of them. They're called, the name is Silverado. Just a cavalcade of knowledgeable, professional, loving, competent people. And we never told her she was in hospice. She received excellent care. And for a woman who was too mean to die and too stubborn and announced that she wanted to live to be 100, which meant that I had to consider suicide at that point, she finally kicked the bucket, bought the farm, and took a cab before Halloween last year. But I loved her hospice nurses, and we can talk more about it. And Michelle, actually, coincidentally, again, Michelle was one of her hospice nurses, not this Michelle, but a Michelle from California. And I just want to give a shout out to our Michelle that we are with today for being in this field, being in this profession. You are angel sent from heaven to walk upon the earth. I could not do what you do. I was the banker, the bookkeeper, the baker. I did all the shopping, but I don't do, how can I say this, fluids and solids that come out of an adult human body. I have a gag reflex. I can't do it. I'm in awe of the hospice nurses who had to deal with the grossest of the gross things that can happen to a human being at the end of their life. So Michelle Lakota, thank you.
That's a very interesting story. And usually from my research, what I've been reading is it takes about 6 months for a person to last in hospice. So 2 years is a long time. So tell us about that process. Tell us when your mother actually went in. So it was an inpatient process, or inpatient hospital that she went into.
She was in her home. She was not going to leave her home. She did have to leave her home by ambulance at one point. She, because she got, well, I should say she was a smoker for 70, as in 70 years.
Wow.
4 packs a day. When she was 86, she had valve replacement surgery at Cedars-Sinai. And she was told she could never smoke again. So it was a perfect storm of, she had heart surgery. She refused any rehab. She didn't want to do it. She refused it. She had to stop smoking. All of her teeth fell out because she was a smoker, and that's what happens when you smoke. So if I can do anything to advocate, stop smoking. It's gross. It's disgusting. Your teeth will fall out. It will give you COPD. It will give you emphysema. It will eventually kill you. She did have valve replacement surgery on the proviso that she would stop smoking. And when she didn't give the surgeon, Dr. Trento, the cardiothoracic surgeon at Cedars, her permission, my uncle, her brother, gave the permission and told his sister, my mother, that she would no longer be a smoker. She quit cold turkey, not a piece of cigarette gum, nothing. She was that strong-willed. But it was just the kind of thing where she did a slow fade to black, and there were a couple of scares. She did have to go by ambulance when she developed what they thought was pneumonia and was hospitalized for a week. And when a human body lies there undead, like a living corpse in a morgue in a bed, and doesn't move and doesn't walk and refuses exercise, and then the physical therapists stop coming because they're not willing to squeeze a ball or lift a leg, it is a very agonizingly slow and not pretty protracted stay in the life of the living. So because of, she was such a pain in the ass, patient, and get this, she was paying caregivers. She had round the clock caregivers. She had hospice nurses coming twice a week or more if there was an emergency. And she stopped, this is the gross part, but she stopped getting out of bed, which was her only exercise, to walk down the hall, 11 steps to the bathroom to use the toilet. She would not use a commode. And I said, Mom, this is horrible. This is disgusting. You are now turning into a baby. You're eating baby food. You're eating soft food because you have no teeth. This is my relationship with my mother. You are wearing diapers and you are having tantrums. You're a baby. And she said, and I quote, I am paying them so much money, they can wipe my ass. And I said, somehow you telling me to act like a lady my whole life has just gone out the window. So she was, it was really bad because her life was so horrible. She watched Bones, Castle, NCIS, and Blue Bloods on a loop, round the clock. She would be Dolly Levi at the Harmonia Gardens if somebody showed up. But I'm the middle child of five kids.
Wow.
I'm the only one in town. I, sidebar, had 18 surgeries from 2006 to 2016. And I've had a lot of spine surgery. I'm filled with titanium rods and screws. And when I had to break the news to my mother that I had to have spine surgery, her loving maternal response was, well, what about me? And I said, well, what about you? This is my body that's going to be cracked open like a lobster, not yours. So anyway, it was difficult. And I guess this is the caregivers and the hospice nurses alerted me that this is a function of dementia. Her brain was slowly turning into, you know, old oatmeal from lack of stimulation, lack of her ophthalmologist told her that a human brain, we need to look at blue sky and green foliage at least 30 minutes a day to activate our dendrites and our brain cells and not have our hippocampus turn into a piece of shredded wheat. She refused that. She had blackout curtains in her room. She didn't even want to look out a window at the sky. So she, I viewed her as just this, she stopped being my mother. She started being a science project. She's very abusive to the people who were doing the most for her, which were included me, her caregivers, and her hospice nurses. We were the ones, we were the you know, the elves and the caregivers, and I would bake for her and cook for her and shop for her. And the more I did for her, the more it was emblematic of how dependent she was on me. And instead of being grateful or thanking me, she just treated me horribly. And I was mortified at the way she treated her nurses and caregivers. And they were great counselors and therapists for me because I had never experienced this kind of old person behavior. My father died when I was 15 of cancer, and he was just a darling love bug until he passed away. My grandmother died at 87. Wonderful. All my relatives who had died were never mean or bitter or left this world kicking and screaming. So it's a dirty job.
It sounds like just a very... How can I say this? It is a very hard experience. And I'm going to throw it over to Michelle right now to kind of tell us a little bit about the hospice experience.
So if you don't mind me just sort of piggybacking on listening to your story. So just to throw a little bit of a comedic element in there, as I listen to you tell this tale, it reminded me of Dolores Claiborne a little bit. And so, you know, just hearing some of the things that you said and you know, her behaviors, having not known her and listening to all those elements, for one, I don't think that any of us have ever had a day in our life where we were sick or getting sick or felt sick and we needed someone to tell us that, right? So we feel what's happening to us. And it sounds like, you know, all of those things that she was, I guess displacing, was the only piece of that whole scenario that she had any control over. And so when you are in this place where she's in that bed and regardless of how her thoughts were processing, she was in there just stuck with her thoughts all the time. And so there's no right or wrong way to deal with that. And there's no, you know, condoning or disapproving of those behaviors on my part. It just was relational to that scenario in that she could not control what was happening to her body. She could not control whatever life review she was doing up until this point, and she couldn't control how it was going to proceed from here to the end. But she could control, you know, yelling at the nurses and, you know, yelling at you. And I think when everything feels so out of control, people grasp at something to just feel grounded. And you know, unfortunately, that sort of manifested in this very agitated, defensive, you know, sometimes crappy scenario. And that's
so insightful, Michelle. It's true that, and for someone who needed and wanted control, she had to come to grips with the fact that we have no control. There is no such thing as control.
Yeah, and just backtracking a little bit, Ursilia, to when you mentioned about, you know, sort of even your perception of hospice. And so we're both nurses. And I think that hospice in general and end-of-life care and conversations are just so drastically misunderstood because we don't talk about them often enough.
Right. It's so taboo in our society. Death is taboo. Nobody wants to talk about it.
Yeah. And I think there's this...
Except for my dates that are counting their summers.
But you know what?
That is sexy. Sexy talk.
I have to say, even, you know, to piggyback on that piece where you said, you know, that was terrifying and I felt the anxiety of that. Or it could also be really empowering because, you know, we don't really pay attention to how much emphasis time has in our lives as individuals and, you know, for our patients. And I think that part of the issue with the fear around death and dying is that, you know, if we talk about it, it's going to happen. So we're not going to talk about it.
Exactly.
You know, if we talk about it, it's uncomfortable and nobody likes to sit in awkward silence or in an uncomfortable space. So we're not going to do that either, you know? And then it sort of becomes this tumbleweed that just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think, you know, as time passes, now it's a monster under your bed.
Right. You know? Yes.
And so we kind of know it's there and we don't want to disturb it. And we know at some point it's going to come out from under that bed, but we are definitely not prompting it to come out from under the bed. You know, and I just think we need to change the jargon in how we're presenting that topic. And really at the core of that is humanity and a celebration of life. And I think that by waiting so long to really get to the core of a person and what they want and how they want to spend their time, we sort of rob them of that opportunity to gain some control and to, you know, make the decisions on how they want to spend it differently. You know, we sort of take that away by not talking about it. And we instill fear, you know, I think in the topic. And so when you had mentioned that with your research, you think people have to be about 6 months out from death to be on hospice, not 2 years. I love that you mentioned 2 years that your mom was on it, because one of the things that makes me the most sad about doing this profession is not that people die. It's when people die poorly. That's what makes me sad. And that this is such an underutilized specialty because it's so misunderstood. So the sort of diagnosis piece is that to be eligible, to meet eligibility for hospice, you have to have been diagnosed with a terminal illness that your practitioner, your physician, you know, is led to believe that without any aggressive or curative goals of care or therapies, that if your disease was allowed to follow its natural course of progression without any interference, that your life would end within 6 months or less. That does not mean that you have to pass away within 6 months or less. And that's the big misunderstanding. And a lot of times, if there was an earlier introduction into the symptom management piece of, you know, all of these different disease processes that people are facing, they actually tend to have a little bit of a different length of longevity because the quality of their life has improved. You know, so when you feel really bad and you're suffering from symptoms of whatever your disease is, you know, that spirals into its own tornado of, I don't want to, you know, like, I can't do this anymore. But when you're able to manage some of those symptoms, you know, it increases quality, and sometimes the increased quality increases the longevity. And I think that in medicine, we sometimes, because there are so many specialties and there's so many things going on with each person, we tend to focus on an individual issue at a time instead of taking a step back and looking at the whole person and all of their comorbidities and everything that's going on. And so, you know, even though we're referring specialty to specialty, I think we tend to, as clinicians, get caught up in what we're focusing on in our particular specialty, but we all are responsible to take a step back and look at all of the other pieces, even if they're not our specialty, about what does that big picture look like? And how does this one, you know, maybe treatment or intervention that I can offer you really affect your whole picture, not just this one part of you? And I think that's the piece that's missing, you know? And when we do introduce,
and I agree with you, Michelle, and I think that that's not only missing in hospice, I think that's missing in healthcare as a whole altogether.
Yeah.
You know, because there's so many different specialties, and a lot of times people don't communicate, or they just want to deal with their part and not deal with anything with all the other components. But I can only imagine in hospice what that's like. And Steph, if you want to go ahead and elaborate a little bit more on that as well.
Sure. I think too, how we introduced that topic, instead of saying, you know, there's nothing more that we can do for you, so now we're going to put you on hospice. So right there, I'd love to pause, because I have never met anyone who was dying that didn't need anything else done for them. It doesn't happen that way.
Just underscore what Michelle said earlier. I'm a professional communicator. I'm a teacher. I'm a writer. I have stories. I tell stories. It was so fascinating that my mother had no stories. She did not share stories. We did not know what she wanted for her funeral. We did not know. She did not share with her 5 children, with her 11 grandchildren. She did not communicate. So that stigma of fear about death is such a great reason. This is such a terrific topic for your podcast today. And I, as a permanent perennial student and teacher, started reading about death and dying. And this book called How We Die, Reflections on Life's Final Chapter by Sherwin B. Newlin, was fantastic as a source to educate me as to what my mother was going through, just anatomically, physiologically, what was happening to her body, to her tissue, to her brain. And I think that to have a conversation, it's inevitable. We're all gonna die. We're all dying right now. And to destigmatize it and insert that this is going, unless you're lucky enough to die in your sleep or get hit by a bus or have a heart attack when you're, in your 80s. But I agree wholeheartedly with you and Michelle saying that it needs to be discussed and it needs to be destigmatized. And it's a conversation that you have to have with your relatives when they're younger and healthier. So it's not all this drama and stigma and emotion when the time comes. I know that in 2005, I had to beg my mother to get a will. She didn't have a will. Right.
A lot of people, and it's good that you bring that up, because a lot of people don't have what's called an advance directive. Do you want to talk a little bit about advance directives, Michelle?
I would love to. I think that is a huge topic. And I think when I talk to people, I love to say, you know, discussing your advance care planning should really happen once a year. You should review it like when you do your taxes. And it sounds really comical, but for multiple reasons, because one, I think because we're so afraid to talk about it, you know, we don't want to talk about it because we talk about it might happen. If we write it down, God forbid we write it down on any kind of, you know, piece of paper or something that we're notarizing, it's definitely going to happen. So we're not doing that either. So just to your point, I mean, there were 5 of you and you had no idea what she wanted. And, you know, the physical part of our beings is just one part. I mean, there's mind, body, spirit component to all of us, and there's so much to process. And so, you know, when you're making a will and when you're going through those scenarios, I say yearly to review that, because one, your relationship with people changes constantly throughout your life.
True.
So you sit down at a certain point in your life and you name a person who you wholeheartedly have to trust is going to actually stand up and advocate for what it is that you want and be able to be emotionally disconnected just enough to not then instill their own, you know, I guess, concerns or be overwhelmed with the decisions that they're having to make for you, because, you know, whomever you name has a tremendous amount of power at the time when you no longer are able to speak for yourself. And then, you know, your life experience change from day to day. So you might have sat down and said, you know, hey, if this particular, if I get into a car accident and I need to be intubated and I,
that's a huge one, right?
You know, you might say at that time, listen, this is what's going on in my life. Yes, please try all of those things. But then, you know, if you wait 5 years to look at that paper again, you may have had some experience in your life where you might have experienced one of the things you previously said you wanted done. And now, you know, you don't want that done ever again. But if you never revisit those papers, that's what's there.
Well, I need to congratulate myself because I can't expect my siblings to do it because they didn't. But I was the only one in LA. They're scattered around the country. And I just had to be the tough love daughter. By then I was more of a parent. And I said, Mom, you've got to have a will. And she said, well, she didn't want to spend the money to do it. And I said, you need to put your money in a trust. And not that she had a lot, but that was all she had. And
wow.
And I said, so she said, okay, I want, first she said, I'm so, so dumb. First she said, well, I just want to leave everything to you because you've done everything. She changed her tune about that. But I said, Mom, you have five kids. You have to, it's got to be a five-way split. And she said, okay, I want you to be the executor. And I said, you know what? I don't want that full responsibility. I'm going to ask my sister to be co-executor with me because I didn't want my low-life Berman siblings coming in court. And I just didn't want drama.
And, yeah, it's pretty intense.
When somebody's dead, it's all about stuff and money. So, So I flew my sister in. We went to the lawyer. We put her money in a trust. I urge everyone to do that. If you love people, make their lives easier after you're dead. So we did the will. We put her money in a trust. She really didn't understand what that was. She wasn't that educated about what that meant, but it preserved her little nest egg to be able to pay for the caregivers, to be able to stay in her apartment until she died. And then what I did, stroke of genius, in April of 2016, I prepaid all her burial expenses. So when she died, more than a year and a half later, I had Hillside on speed dial, and yes, I spent 20 minutes with her dead body. That was interesting. Until the men in black came and put her in the body bag and took her away, but it was all done. So the next day, my son and I went to the cemetery, gave them her nightgown to wear in the coffin, and it all sounds macabre, and it all sounds kind of heartless, but it was so easy. The bigger gift would have been if we had cleaned out her apartment starting 4 years ago. But it's planning, and I know I have three sons. I'm a single mom, and I at one point said to them, "Okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take two cans of dog food and a can opener and go in an Uber to the Angeles National Forest and smear my body with dog food and take all the clothes in my house and lay down in the dirt and let the animals have a feast. And you don't have the burden to do all that." And then they said, "But Mom, there are no animals in the Angeles National Forest." I said, "Okay, that would be like the supreme irony. I go to a forest where there are no animals, and I'm just covered with dog food and die of hypothermia." But if you love your relatives, you have to do the advance directive. You have to plan the will. You have to talk about it. My kids and I talk about it freely. My grandma and I talked about it all the time. It made, like you said, Michelle, it made my grandma's life a celebration. And it's, why is death a taboo subject in this crazy?
I think that's a good idea. Let's jump to Michelle with that. Why is death a taboo subject? And I know you've been going to death cafes. recently, so, and you can kind of talk about what those are about.
Yep, absolutely. So I love that you use the word gift, because honestly, it really is what you, that whole planning piece is what you've done is a gift. And even the dog food story, I mean, you know, I want to touch on that because we can sit and laugh about it. But you know what people don't realize is that there really are no rules to all of this planning. And I think that getting to where things become taboo is because when we don't talk about them, again, it, you know, there's this whole mystery behind it. And the life celebration can't happen. The death cafe piece is something that I heard about, I researched, I started going to in the community. And so the history behind death cafes is it was started in London by this gentleman, John Underwood, and his mother, and they started it out of their home. And he just was sort of fascinated with having the conversations too that people weren't having. And the idea behind that is not to have a fixed agenda. It's just to invite really strangers to get together at a, you know, at a common meeting place, whether that be I've been at a death cafe that was in a Starbucks, and I was at one that was in the library, and you come together and, you know, I might have a particular thing that I'd like to discuss while I'm there, but there's the concept is not to lead anybody to any end decision or big discovery. It's literally just to provide a safe space that is non-judgmental in advance of any crisis that is happening, so that you're not, you know, in a situation where you have information overload and you really can't process all of these things to talk about them. And it's really interesting the things that come up. So, you know, when you go, they give you a little bit of the history. It's about a 45-minute meeting, and there are, they give you a pamphlet of sort of trigger questions to kind of spark your conversation. And it just manifests into these beautiful conversations, because everybody's bringing with them different life experiences and different pieces of history, and you're intergenerational, and you may be sitting with someone that you wouldn't normally cross paths with on your everyday. And they're wonderful to get people to just start talking about these things. And I mean,
funeral. So what type of people go to these? Are they people who have suffered a death, or people, you know, just curious about death?
So I think a little bit of everybody. Some people haven't talked about it. I've sat at a table where death happened and they just kept moving. You know, it wasn't in their culture or in their tradition to sit down and process that. I sat with somebody who had lost a good friend at childhood, and they were so worried about talking about it with her that they just never allowed her space to talk about it. And it became this thing that she carried around, you know, silently. And I think that's something that we have to remember too. When you meet anybody, no matter where you're meeting them, everybody's walking with something, you know, and we don't always put it on the table. And you never know how not talking about something is affecting someone, and how much of a barrier it's creating. I mean, funeral planning, again, yes, to some might sound macabre, but I think as medicine has modernized over the last, let's say, 100 years, you know, people used to take care of everyone in the home. That's how it went.
Right. People used to die in the home. I mean, yeah. I remember when I was a kid, I was in Italy about 13 or 14 years old. And even back then, and I was talking, I think this was in the mid to late 80s. There was someone who had died in their home. They kept the casket in their home, you know, and people would go and pay their last respects. And then they would go throughout the little town and they would have like a parade. I mean, there was a band and then there were grievers. There was a group of grieving, like nun ladies, or weren't really nuns, you know? And so then there were all these different facets and the priests would go by, and it was this whole thing. It was very, very interesting. And then you would hear the old people as this whole procession would go by, and they'd be like, I don't want a band for my funeral. You know, they're all like, I don't want flowers for my funeral, you know, or what they would want. It was really fun. I mean, it was really interesting. And as a kid, it was like, oh my God, what is going on? You know?
It's what everything we're talking about is about bringing it out into the light and out of the morgue and talking about it, because there is a fascination. It's not, I would go to my mother's and I would see like this Stan Winston Creature Shop corpse on, she's watching NCIS, and I would say, oh, I can't even look at that. That's so disgusting. Mom, how can you be watching the show when you're going to be looking like that in a couple of years? Like, you could be the stand-in for that. And I would try to lighten it up, and she would tell me that, you know, I was disrespectful. And I said, Mom, it's life. You're lying there pooping in your pants telling me I'm being disrespectful, making a joke about the fake corpse on NCIS. But it's talking about things. It's bringing what is so shrouded in. It's why Lincoln in the Bardo, the fabulous book by George Sanders, is about, I don't know if everybody knows it, but you must read it. It's about the night that Todd Lincoln died, and the Lincolns were having a party in the White House while his favorite son was dying. And then he goes back, and this is true, he went back to the crypt many times that night to hold his dead child. And wow. All the spirits of all of the dead people it's such a fabulous novel, and it is powerful, it's entertaining, it's metaphysical, and it's what our fascination is, you know, to reference Sean Cunningham and all.
Yes, and I want to jump into that. Perfect segue, Lisa. That's a great segue to jump into Michelle's movie, The Nurse with the Purple Hair, and how all that came about.
The Nurse with the Purple Hair. An unlikely pairing of a horror filmmaker with a compassionate, insightful, and funny hospice worker create extraordinary results.
It's a documentary, and it's meant to honor hospice workers and the work that they do. It's very important, and it's misunderstood. I think that's what has been my motivation to make the movie. Mostly, I find that death is a subject that we just don't talk about, and we should. Not to say that it's grim or morbid, but it's a major part of what we do. And that as we come to the end of our lives, we're not prepared for what's going to happen. And the people around us aren't prepared for it. And then I met some of the people who actually deal with this. And their attitudes were so different than you would have expected. They're really enlightening, and I think what they're doing is very important.
And so I think it's just very interesting that a horror movie director made such a film, but he made it with a lot of light too. So why don't you go ahead and talk about that, Michelle?
Yeah, positively. So I totally believe that happening was a cross between the universe and divine intervention. And just, you know, aside from being a nurse, I'm just a movie nerd, and horror is my favorite genre. And I started to work at different Comic Cons with celebrities as a celebrity assistant. And that's where I first met Sean. And it was within the first hour that we met that he asked me, what did I really do? You know, what was my day job? And so I told him hospice nurse. And immediately his wife had gotten tearful. And so here she shared with me that her mom had just passed with hospice just days before our meeting. Wow. And that opened up this dialogue to discuss death and dying throughout the time that we were at this event. And, you know, Sean had an experience in the utilization of hospice with his father many years before that. And even though he had that, his wife's experience was just, they were very different experiences for each of them. And so we sat down and he said, you know, do you mind if I pick your brain about this? And I just talked about, you know, some of the things we're talking about, how, you know, it has become this taboo thing. And you know, as medicine has advanced, we've somehow convinced society that in order to be cared for, you must be in the hospital, you know? And so that trend began. And then now that you're in the hospital, now we've convinced people that you must be hands off too, right? It has to be only clinicians. And I feel like there's this no touch, you know, theory insinuated. And so we've backed off and off and off and off to the point where we feel like, you know, having those conversations of being comical are disrespectful. Says who? Where are these rules? They don't exist. They just don't exist. You know, some people deal with this by humor. Some people deal with it by not dealing with it at all. Some people choose to be angry, all of which is okay because there's no rule book for how this happens. And so we kept, you know, the dialogue going. And I said, you know, Hollywood truthfully doesn't help us in the medical profession or in the lay community because it paints these very, you know, fantasized pictures of The Notebook, you know, and that's just, right.
That's a great movie to bring up. And
in truth, are there notebook stories? Yes, absolutely. And those are absolutely beautiful when you are, you know, I feel honored to be in the presence of such a vulnerable space with everyone I meet, no matter how their process goes. But yeah, so there are those notebook moments, but most of them are not, and they're very different. And they're, you know, they're very different because we're different as individuals. So we kept talking, and about 6 months later, Sean contacted me and he said, you know, I haven't been able to stop thinking about what you said. And I think that you're right. I think there's not enough education. I think people don't understand this, and it can be this really beautiful thing. And what do you say we make a movie together? And so we did just that. And it's from an interdisciplinary perspective. And it's really myself and all the members of the team, which would include physicians and nurse practitioners and social work and chaplain and volunteer and bereavement coordinators. And, you know, hospice care is the most care that anybody can get at home, because it is the one area of medicine where it is regulated to have a interdisciplinary team taking care of you and offering you care from the mind, body, spirit perspective. And I think that people associate hospice with, you know, you must be days, hours to days from dying, because we are referring people so late in the process because we have avoided it as a medical community and as a lay community, that the general association is, you know, you have to be hours or days from death. And that's just simply not true. Most people who utilize that service that we can associate with have been hours to days from death, because that's when we, and I say we as hospice, that's when we have met them. We didn't come in and make them die in hours or days. We met them hours or days before they were dying. And we should be meeting them much sooner than that.
I think you're right, Michelle. And I feel like my mother's life was extended probably maybe almost 3 years, because she was having such great care. People were touching her, caring about her. She allowed them, sometimes she didn't allow them to be touched. Her doctor who visited her turned into her boyfriend. We would tell her, your boyfriend's here. You oh, darling. So loving. But she was the biggest flirt with no teeth, and she would get coquettish and flirtatious. But it was releasing oxytocin in her brain to have that attention.
That concludes part one of that difficult conversation called death. Stay tuned for next week's episode, part two, as we go in deeper into that difficult conversation and we hear what Lisa is going to be asking Michelle. What mind-blowing question does she have about death? Now, you can follow us on Facebook under Nurses and Hypochondriacs Podcast. We're on Twitter, Nurses and Hypochondriacs Podcast as well. And on Instagram, you can follow us under Rogue Nurse Media. And go ahead and feel free to throw us some change on our GoFundMe page under Nurses and Hypochondriacs Podcast. Thank you so much.